There is no solid data that can assess with accuracy how the Orthodox community compares to the rest of the world. But there was a lot of anecdotal evidence coming up that, and also small pieces of data that suggest that abuse in the Orthodox community is just as prominent. It occurs in the same numbers as abuse everywhere else. There were a couple of sort of small studies that suggest that somewhere between 20 to 25% of all Orthodox women, for example, have experienced abuse. And those numbers are similar to what happens in the rest of the world, and the rest of the Western world, let's say in America and Israel. These numbers are pretty consistent. Somewhere to 20 to 30% of people experience this. And the limited data that we have on the Orthodox community suggests that it's the same.
There has been a tendency in the ultra-Orthodox world not to wash their dirty linen in public. Even
Right.
this very prominent case this week with Chaim Walder was hardly mentioned. His crimes were hardly mentioned. That's to say,
Right.
it was just described as he died without mentioning the facts behind the suicide and why. All the details of the case. Is
Right.
this still the case in the ultra-Orthodox world?
That's an excellent question. The Chaim Walder case was the first case in my memory, and a lot of people who work in this field also said that this is the first case where his employers did immediately fire him. You know, the stores that he worked for, the newspapers, the stores that sold his books, the newspapers and radio stations that he worked for fired him pretty fast. And not only that, but the Rabbi Eliyahu, you know, the head of Beit Din from Sfat, believed the victims. He was collecting stories. The Chaim Walder, the first stories, there were about three or four victims who came forward. But in the meantime, Rabbi Eliyahu was collecting stories, and he has 22 or something like that people who approached him
And to
about
his
that were victims.
credit, he was very outspoken in
Yes.
criticizing
Yes.
this case.
So that's on one hand. So on the one hand, when that started happening, when people started, you know, when it, people started reacting this way to Walder, there was sort of a sense like, oh, are things changing now? But the thing is that with the suicide was like his last act of controlling the narrative. Because what happens after he committed suicide is that there's a little bit of that whitewashing happening again. Because it's like, oh, you know, now he's a victim himself, feel sorry for him. In his last, you know, whatever note he left, it was like, oh, please respect my books and respect my stories. And there's that, you know, whole tradition in Judaism, you know, you don't want to speak evil of people as they die. You say Baruch Dayan Emet, you know, like
Not
that.
a,
So
not, not only
that has
that,
come.
not only that, we have the chief rabbi of Israel, David
Yes.
Lau, visiting the
Yes,
family to make a shiva
exactly.
call.
Exactly. I wrote about that yesterday on Facebook also. That was really very troubling. Extremely troubling, you know, and especially because yesterday also one of Walder's victims committed suicide. There was this, you know, story of a girl who after Walder committed suicide, this woman who, I mean, she's a woman, okay? She was victimized by him when she was younger, but you know, she committed suicide. You don't see the chief rabbi going to console her family. And so here we are back in this dynamic where the abuser receives more sympathy because, oh, you know, poor guy. So that whole, you know, when a sexual abuser commits suicide, it's an act of like control. It's a form of control. It's a form of shutting down the conversation again, of, you know, making sure that the victims won't get up in court and tell their stories. It's the ultimate silencing technique. It's the ultimate, you know, control technique. And that could really very badly affect victims. Other victims, you know, might also feel a certain kind of guilt about, oh my God, I caused this guy to commit suicide, because, you know, a lot of victims do on some level feel guilt and feel shame and feel responsible for their abuse. So that's a really terrible thing that's happening in victims now. But and also it pulls back on that, you know, because until then there was a very positive dynamic developing where the community was taking note and saying, okay, let's listen to victims and let's pay attention to what's happening. But since the suicide, since Valda's suicide, it's like it's scaling back a little bit, you know, because of that.
And so, that pattern of control, of course, is common across society in all cases of rape and sexual abuse, not yes. just the ultra-Orthodox world.
Yes.
And another phenomenon is that not all the abusers are always men. There have been yes. cases, of course, Malka Leifa being the most infamous, of women abusers.
In terms of gender, absolutely, abusers can be all genders and victims can be all genders, of course. However, it is worth pointing out that an estimated 93% of abusers are men, and that there is a certain overlap between sexual abuse and gender, because gender creates power dynamics. You know, there are power dynamics all around our community, places where men are more likely to be in a position of authority, men are more likely to be the principal of a school, or the men are more likely to be on the radio and television, especially in the Orthodox world where women aren't even allowed to be seen in public, and there are a lot of limitations on what kind of power women are allowed to have. And so the power dynamic, the gender power dynamic, whether it's power, visibility, authority, money, or networking, you know, rabbis who connect with other rabbis, who support other rabbis about who has the higher profile, who has the voice, who becomes famous, who becomes a celebrity. So there is an overlap between those power dynamics and gender, because men are more likely to have those positions of power and authority. So that's why sexual abuse is a kind of gendered thing in many cases, because of that. And that's what overlaps with the statistic of, you know, 93% of abusers are men. However, among kids, actually, it's somewhere around 50-50 in terms of who the victims are. You know, as kids, boys and girls are roughly just as likely to be victims of sexual abuse. So, but nevertheless, what's interesting about the, or sad or upsetting about the, when it's a female abuser, is that sometimes it's hard to believe, right? So victims who come out and talk about being abused by a woman, they're often poo-pooed, you know, or one victim told me that when she was trying to tell people that she was abused by a woman in the Orthodox community, they said, oh, well, lesbianism isn't against halacha, you know, for example. Like, oh, it's no big deal. It's just a woman. Also, you know, the idea that women are sort of seen as safe, you know, for better and for worse, if you take a, you know, a self-defense course. And self-defense courses, they teach you, if you're in a position of danger, you're on the street and you're being attacked, go find a woman because women are safe because of the statistic that, you know, almost all abusers are men. But because of that same kind of statistic, it sort of internalized this idea like, oh, women don't abuse. You know, oh, women aren't that way. But it's not true. It's not true. And also people have like all kinds of like technical questions. What does it mean that a woman can be a sexual abuser? What does it mean that a woman can rape? How can a woman rape? You know, so people have like a lot of those kinds of questions. But it's true that sexual abuse can take place by women. It doesn't necessarily need a male anatomy. You know, there are lots of things that can be used for rape. Okay. And I'd rather, you know, we don't have to go into graphic detail here. Okay. But, you know, women can rape, women can sexually abuse, and not all sexual abuse even necessarily involves rape. Okay. Or even touch. There are lots of different kinds of emotional sexual abuse that take place that can also be cruel and tormenting. And as a society, we don't always know all this. And so when the abuser is a woman, people have like a lot of questions and they sort of doubt it. And like, well, it can't be. And it doesn't fit in with what we think about as women, you know, but it's there. It exists. And women abusers should be treated the same way as male abusers. Their grooming tactics are often the same. The narcissistic behaviors are often the same. The control, the secrecy, all of those things are the same between male and female abusers for the most part.